Rebarsha Olam, we enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Ga'enai va'abita nifla'ot me'torteha. Okay, so we spent a lot of time talking about the kind of rectified expression of shame being ayin, like ayin, no self, small self, transparent self, and the rectified expression of the other side of the coin of narcissism is ani, which is, in the unrectified sense, inflated self. And that there are, like in the spiritual life and spiritual path, so we are trying to move, like kind of to take whatever the experiences of shame that come up in our life and kind of, direct them towards a more rectified expression, i.e., of ayin in the spiritual sense of the word, transparent self, and to take the unrectified expression of narcissism and move it into a more rectified sense of self. So, and we looked at Moshe as the archetype of going from ani to ayin, and we looked at Chava as the archetype of going from ayin to ani, the more feminine, like the, it's, in some sense premised on teachings from the first book, the Kabbalistic Writing to the Nature of Masculine and Feminine, where we kind of looked and spent time with, well, we didn't hear, we did briefly, but because there's a little box that kind of summarizes all that in a single page, but the Ari's teaching on the seven stages of feminine development, the moon cycle, where the feminine in her malchut, lowest state, is like the moon, late lava grama klum. She has nothing of her own, only what she receives from the sun. And the masculine in the malchut, or starting point, starting gate, so to speak, generally has an ego that needs to be tamed and clarified. So that kind of dropped us off, that exploration drops us off here with the last few pages before we go into the practical, treatment, how to, like, practical relationship to shame. And that is that in the path from ayin to ani, which is the feminine, the Chava was the archetype, so it's really also a path of individuation. And so there are certain, like, shame challenges that are inherent in individuation that it's important to just note and to just be aware of, because it's it helps to bring some kind of sense and order to the challenges of life when you understand what's going on, the deeper sense of what's going on. So that is on page 220. Does anybody have books?
Do you have one?
I don't. No, she doesn't.
She wanted to finish the last chapter of the blue poem.
Yeah, okay.
219. She's not here, but I think they're all gone.
Okay. But you can share.
It's okay.
It's really.
Okay. So we were in, so to just, because part of what individuation is, what's happening there, is that it is a kind of nisirah, a surgical uncoupling, like one is like part of a herd, And then one is sort of stepping out from that, which is what's happening in individuation is that one is kind of part of a community or of a herd, so to speak, and then is stepping out in a certain way and becoming more individuated, which oftentimes means like the balance of identification between the herd and one's sense of self becomes strained. So and Nisi Ra is classically the way that term is used is in the seven stages of feminine development. There's even though there are seven stages, there are basically three phases. There's the back-to-back phase, there's the front-to-front phase of relationship, and then in between them is the Nisi Ra, the surgical untoupling, which is really explicit in the story of Adam and Chava. They start off as bound back-to-back as an androgynous entity, like Siamese twins. Hashem puts Adam asleep, surgically uncouples, and they come out the other side capable of having a front-to-front relationship. So we're looking at, there's a summary. What page is it on?
290.
Okay.
Column, halfway down the column.
So I just got.
That helps. Is that what you wanted?
Yeah, that is exactly what I wanted. But I think that I might just start at the beginning. This. I think so, since there's so many new people. Okay, so this is a very brief summary of the Aries Kabbalistic model of relationship, because that is, thanks, Hanva. Because this individuation process is really also, as I just said, entails a kind of Nisi Ra, and so it does follow the same pattern of things. So based on it, and the way the class works is that we go around the circle reading paragraph after paragraph. So each person reads a paragraph or two, and then passes it on. So I start. So let me make sure I'm lying. Yes.
Do you make the book?
No, I don't. I gave it to them already.
I know she's been serving me now for the few she wants to have. She wants to buy them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So based on a Talmudic tale about the sun and moon, Jewish mystical writings identify seven stages that mark the evolving relationship of masculine and feminine through history. Since it's the moon, our cosmic feminine, that does the waxing and waning, these changes are all presented as stepping stones that mark the feminine life cycle. So meaning that the feminine life cycle, as it's discussed in Kabbalah, basically is also like inseparable from the feminine's relationship to the masculine. So it's all about how the two of them negotiate a back-to-back relationship, a surgical uncoupling, and then a turning into front-to-front relationship. I think I say this here, that it doesn't happen in one fell swoop, though. The reality of it is that every relationship has aspects that are front-to-front and aspects that are back-to-back. Front-to-front are healthy. Back-to-back is more... dysfunctional. and as the relationship evolves and a person becomes more self-aware, so then those new aspects of the self, of the psyche, become available then for a front-to-front relationship and partnership. Like there's like really were so also with us. It's a, you know, our life journey is a process of coming into more and more knowledge of who we are, really. And the more we discover ourselves, the more conscious we can be in our relationships, and the more of ourself is available to be conscious in relationships. So this model plays out on all scales, this front-to-front, Nisira, back-to-back, back-to-back, Nisira, front-to-front. This model plays out on all scales, from the span of an individual woman's life to the history of creation, for the entire period of existence, from beginning to end, is but a single circuit of the cosmic moon. These seven stages divide into three primary phases. Back-to-back equality, surgical uncoupling and collapse, front-to-front equality that is even more consummate than was possible before. The reason that this three, and there's really seven that I've left out, is that number one, phase one and phase three are a developmental process. It doesn't start off equal. It starts off skewed, and then the relationship evolves more because the feminine is the one that's in motion. The masculine holds the pole of Shlemut, and the feminine is as Hishtalmut, of perfection. And so the feminine is moving towards the ultimate ideal, as presented by the RE, is that the seventh stage, which is the last stage that we get to, the masculine and feminine meet, in the Ari's words, panim v'panim, face to face, v'shave l'gamri, and completely equal. That's the goal. That's the ideal. I was shocked when I discovered that in here, but that's what it says.
Good question.
Yeah.
So seven phases of the moon are divided into the month as 4 days each. We're going to give you the 28-day cycle?
Well, it actually could be. I mean, he doesn't, like, fix it like that. It's more like a general development of relationships.
You have other sources that say that the growth, the waxing of the moons will stop eventually.
Right.
This point, right? At the full moon.
Right. At Shavir.
Yeah. So then what happens to that monthness? Even the three cycles are not three groups of ten. They're
right
up to the 15th of the month, and then back into
right, the moon goes. Right. But it is true that that's, you know, that's the promise, is that the moon would, like, it's a question, there is a question, and what does it mean that the moon before her diminishment? Did she not have cycles? Like, there are opinions that no, she didn't. Yes, she did. What are the other? I can't remember. I don't recall there being a real kind of explicit connection between the front-to-front, back-to-back, Nisira, front-to-front, in relation to the time.
Does it ever say anything like that the Earth wasn't there, so it couldn't be diminished? Like, it didn't have a shadow on it?
I don't know, but there is an idea that this is a scientific thing, but it is connected, which is that the light from the sun is chaotic. It's like the beams and rays are like kind of not polarized. They're going in all different directions, and so there is a limit. Like, it's not as powerful or potent as it could be, and that the light of the sun, when the moon used to be like ice, and ice, like, magnifies light and works with it. And so the light that reflected from the moon was now polarized. Polarized light is like a laser beam that can cut through a diamond. And so it's a higher order light than the raw material that it was receiving from the sun. And so there is an opinion, I mean, because the Balatanya takes the Arya's teaching and takes it another step further and says that, that like a spring compressed and released, the feminine that is engaged in the Hishtal mood, the perfect teen, but which always happens through Yuri Dalit Saras Aliyah, a fall or a diminishment that kind of then energizes the growth spurt. So that because of that, the feminine is going to eventually overshoot her Ben-Zug, and Aishas Chala Teret Bala, he says, is where the feminine becomes not just the, like the feminine, her crown is extending beyond his crown, and she is the Mashpia. The question becomes, and is it just going to be reversed, and he's going to be now be oppressed by her? But the idea is that the structure of reality that the feminine will kind of bring with her when she kind of comes into that, her full stature, is a circular model, a non-hierarchical circular model, where every soul or every individual is equidistant from the center, from Hashem in the center, so to speak. And so it will usher in the next phase of history, which is it's called the circle world. And then there's on the way down, there was the Akudim, which is the bound world, Tin Sirot, in a single vessel that was like kind of forced communality. And then that was an unrectified world absorbed back into divinity. And the next like world was the circle world or Nikudo point world, which is where Shira Detailing happened. And then the third stage of things was the called Yosher or Olam HaTikun, which is our world, which has the ten spherot as individuality, but it's all the individual spherot are woven together in interconnecting pathways that weave it into a larger, higher order unity called Adam. And so that's Olam HaTikun, that's our world.
And the metaphor about the moon being like ice and focusing like a laser was from?
That's science, basically. But there is, I can't remember the name of the sefer because I didn't really read the whole thing. I just, someone gave it over to me, the teaching of it. It's, Rabbi Ginsburg recommended it. So it's a Chabad teaching about the moon. I can find it. I have it in my bookshelf.
But I was told when you said that the crown will be on top of the women and face to face.
Yes.
Because they said that the Achavit Yamin, the women will go and the men will. And it will be face to face.
Yeah, but everyone will be happy. Yeah. Everyone will be the full,
I'm not
their full self. You're not sure?
The men will be happy.
I think they are. I think they're going to be happy. That's the promise.
No, but I would go with this explanation that you mentioned with face to face, because face to face is like funny to funny.
Right.
It's not one is taller than the other.
And well, no, but that's
the crown. But when we put the crown, so it means there is like a statement there.
Right, but face to face doesn't mean equal yet. If equality is something that they get to, you know, start off with the feminine diminished. After the Nisira, she diminishes very much, and then she has to slowly come up, and then she's going to surpass. She's going to bring him up to her, and the two of them are going to be in circle consciousness.
But she needs to bring him to him, or he needs to come from up down.
No, she's going to bring him. She's going to, like right now, the feminine is diminished. Like when in the Nisira, the feminine diminishes. And then what happens? She's now too small to hold all the lights and consciousness that she had before. So what happens to those? So he, most of that gets absorbed by her benzoic, and his job, and he can use them, he's permitted to use them. He's like the trustee of these lights.
Okay.
And, but he, on the condition that he passes them on to her when she becomes ready to, you know, comes into her fullness, into her stature.
Okay.
And he, like, it's a complicated thing, and there's a lot of territorial issues that come up in that phase of things. But eventually, she, like, even though they're not equal, they're still face to face. And so as she kind of comes into her fullness of stature, so then she overshoots, pulls him up, and they kind of, yeah.
Like the passage, the ein bein ja overshoot a shemtion, it means my mass is the same.
Right. Okay. So
it's also, I just want to, also every person, men and women, has both of these sides in
yes.
them. So
yes.
it's not, mm-hmm. not that the men, it will that the men maybe have more men punot in them as more than women, but they
right.
all of our, we're all created with this,
right.
So,
right.
I don't know how
especially,
the men will get, but they're sadly will, but maybe because their tzadnik zi will be so mekutah, they'll not get upset. That's the whole idea.
Right. I think we're, like, with enough consciousness, everything works.
Enough consciousness.
Right. But that's kind of what, that's what's happening.
What's interesting is, to your point, this idea that where it says completely equal, does it say, could it be like within the, each person that the masculine and feminine is equal? That's not that the man and the...
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it requires both.
Now we're lopsided.
You won't see that she's taking from him back.
No. With enough consciousness, it's just like...
It's like giving.
Yeah.
It's all together.
Right. Right. So wait, I was going to say something about the cell. Right. Like, for example, what Dina was saying is that, I mean, in relation to what she was saying, that really any system or any individual that is growing, like evolving, growing, is manifesting feminine tchunot. Like that's hishtabluot is in the archetypal sense of things. Like we're not archetypes, we're people. And so we are in the people from Olam HaTikun, and the major distinguishing feature of Olam HaTikun is that it's a holographic world where everything contains aspects of everything else inside it. So on an archetypal level, which is where it's not inter-includedness or barely, the masculine modality is Shleimud. It's the Yateh Ne'aman, the tent peg that doesn't budge no matter how much the wind blows the tent. It's just stable and reliable, faithful. And and Hishtamut, which is the perfecting aspect of things, is associated with the feminine, who, like the waxing and waning, is like the Yuri Dal, the Tsaris Aliyah. And so in some sense, any person or thing that is growing and evolving is actually in Hishtamut modality, which is the feminine, the inner feminine aspect of themselves. Okay, so the seven stage is divided into three primary phases, back-to-back, which eventual equality of back-to-back, surgical uncoupling and collapse, the feminine collapses, and then front-to-front equality that is even more consummate than was possible before. In a back-to-back relationship, the couple's primary bond of attraction derives from projections, unconscious tugs, and external allures. In contrast, a front-to-front relationship is one where the couple shares common goals and a mutuality of desire. The Hebrew term for face, panim, stems from the same root as the word for inwardness, panimiut. A front-facing relationship is one where the couple's insides, panimiut, meet and their souls unite.
The superiority of phase three derives from its preeminence on both the quantitative and the qualitative scales of compatibility. In phase three, the masculine and feminine meet as spiritual equals, face to face, will to will. The eminent and transcendent faces of divinity, the Shekhina and the Holy One, unite from the crown of their heads to the soles of their feet. The Ari describes this messianic culmination as a meeting of equals, of masculine and feminine finally standing, quote, face to face, completely equal, and happily sharing the single crown. Maybe you can read that.
Vayishtabshu panim panim shave legamri. Beit Malachim v'keter echad. So they will, these two will meet face to face and completely equal. And whereas at the beginning the moon was complaining that sharing a single crown was not working, and at which point Hashem says, "You're right. I was waiting for someone to recognize that. So now you diminish yourself." She's like, "Well, that's not fair." But
well, sharing is more important than having two kharim. That
right.
was the message.
Right.
The goal
yes.
is to share.
Yes. Because they're really one. I mean, immanent, I try to convey that in the immanent and transcendent, like, you know, Hashem, the indwelling aspect of Hashem and the surrounding aspect of Hashem. It's just all Hashem, really. It's a little bit more complicated than that. That's what I'm writing about now. But, okay.
Complicated is good. Yes.
For this small circle of people. Right.
It's a process to be uncomplicated. You can't uncomplicate things if they're not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the process is to uncomplicate it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if we were supposed to be given simple lives.
Right. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think in this generation we're all the
you know, sometimes you have the sentences that you say that echo. So Hashem went through a lot of trouble to make us all different. But that's one of the reasons.
Right.
Yet, what's between phase one and phase three is the most dramatic interval of the feminine's journey. The surgical uncoupling that releases the pair turns from back-to-back fusion into face-to-face union. For the feminine, this boon comes at great sacrifice. Its quantum leap forward on the quality scale entails a major backslide on the vertical scale that measures women's access to higher life. Her stature shrinks, even as she gains the possibility of real and front-facing partnership, a prospect that only now appears when the backsided bond is severed, enabling them to turn face-to-face. In phase three, she recovers her stature and they meet and match face to face, tip to toe. The author's previous book, Kabbalistic Writing on the Nature of Masculine and Feminine, presents the source text that expound these ideas.
Just get a sense of it. This is, the Ari goes through history and talks about the approach to equality, like the undiminishment of the moon and then the rediminishment of the moon.
So from left is the Briyat HaOlam, we're going from left to right.
This is the seven stages. Yeah. And this is history. And so it's...
interesting.
Yeah, just to know that...
So it's not going in an order.
It's quite a tumultuous relationship.
Mm-hmm. Balanced.
Yeah. And then this, I mean, just to look at, like, you can see that this is the masculine and feminine and where they started and how the feminine, it doesn't really show her growing the stature so much, but anyway, it's not too bad.
Is that actually the way we saw it physically in this world, or is that more in a higher realm?
It's the Kabbalistic, but I'm sure it has some, if someone would, yeah, this one you're talking about.
Yeah. So that's not something we would be able to actually detect.
I mean, it would be an interesting project to try to look at history and see, you know,
I would love to see this. Do you have the actual? Yes.
I made that.
Oh, you made it?
Yeah.
So you did calculate it?
No, they just wrote, this is all the historical stuff from Kabbalah, and this is the various stages that kind of were active in. But the thing is also that in every stage, there's always individuals that are representing all the other stages, even though the generation itself might be at step 2 out of 7, but there's still individuals there who are on step 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and, you know, kind of holding those places, those poles. Okay, so
you could safely say out of that graph that all the aliyot and yeridot are extreme. They're extreme. They're almost identical in the depth. Like the down and the up are both extreme. They're not like these little lines.
Right.
So
is that chart in the nature class?
No.
Where's the
Yeah, can we find that chart?
It's not published.
But take a picture of
but,
it.
Yeah, you can't take a picture of it.
Thank you so much. It's so cool right now. I also track patterns.
Take a picture?
Really interesting.
Yes, yes. But that's, yeah.
What's the other one?
Yeah. So, the shame entailed in cultivating Ani. The feminine path of enlightenment. That's what I wanted. And so, okay.
There are two ways that shame contributes something positive to growth and transformation. Shame as a precursor to humility associates primarily with the masculine path of ani ka'ani, as explored on page 195. Shame as a negative incentive associates with the feminine path of ayin to ani, or below.
I think, yeah, that's a mistake. I don't know how that popped in there.
We said here we were here, Walt, but we were here.
Yeah.
It should be in the next section.
Right, we said.
So I want to say something. So there, like the first modality, which is the process of going from shame to, from the, Anita Ayan. Is that what I want to say? Yeah, from Anita Ayan. So the shame itself, like the unrectified Ani, is what itself becomes the Ayan, like the humble ego. Whereas it just needs to be, the shame needs to be processed and metabolized and washed through and burnt out, and then that what's left of that is really the ego in its iron state. Whereas the shame as a negative incentive, it really isn't it doesn't end up part of the process, it just motivate some kind of behavior that of avoidance or we're going to see or kind of strengthening of, so that's what we're going to do now, strengthening of one's commitment to individuation. It's too abstract right now. It'll be concrete in a minute.
That's the card.
Will you send Will you send those pictures to the...
To send them? I don't know.
Where do you want her to send them?
To you?
Okay.
To anybody who wants them.
Oh,
thank you.
Awesome. I think these are taken.
Yeah. Okay, so who's reading? Shame as negative incentive.
Shame as negative. The second way that shame contributes positively to our growth path is an extremely potent negative incentive. In trying to avoid or minimize its presence in our life, we must grow, mature, and enlighten. Shame is an aversion emotion that we want to be rid of as quickly as possible. To minimize the amount of shame in our lives, we try to avoid doing things that will bring shame, which basically means making wise decisions, being honest, cultivating integrity, minimizing secrets, keeping promises, and just generally being a mensch.
Right. So that's the kind of negative incentive thing, is that we want to avoid it as much as possible, and that means that, you know, it becomes an incentive to be a mensch, basically. And, right. So did we talk about this? That in, like, kind of the Talmudic writings and also the Zoharic writings, the shame and yira are pretty much kind of used synonymously. That it's like kind of the shame is an incentive, like you fear wanting to, being shamed, and so you behave in a way, you avoid things that are likely to bring shame upon us. So it's not, Hashem's, the Talmud says, do from love, because one who loves won't resent. And do from fear, because one who fears won't get overly confident and start cutting corners. So it's definitely a productive process. I mean, the avoidance of shame it works.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay.
Yeah.
Life is so simple. We just cut those.
Of course.
Right. I mean, and you just see with newspapers, it's all about who's getting shamed this week? Really.
Rabbi Wiener wrote a tshuva about, someone asked him about watching, listening to the news and all these things. And so he said that in general, listening to the news in Israel, listening to the news is not a very good thing to do. All these things, you don't have to listen to it so much. It's only for tshuva and it's not. And then he said, it really says all the same thing. I'm Israel, yes, or Betzalot. Yes, or Betzalot, but I'm Israel. Like, that's the general gist of it.
But he's not only in Israel.
No, he was talking about people here locally, I'm just saying.
Then he said, stop it. When we moved to Singapore, the following day,
uh-huh.
I opened the Straits Times. I didn't need to open this. The first page. What was the picture? On the first page, that the person left the toilet without flush the water. It's not a joke.
Wow.
And it was a fine by $500 or something. And these pictures.
Unbelievable.
I'm talking about many years ago. Mm-hmm. It was
89. Wow.
I was shocked. I said, what we are writing in? I was just saying, what there is there. And it's clear, no one, I can promise you, there's no one after him. Everyone's right. Yeah. When he don't have it, the flesh the water.
There's a lot of also suicides in
Singapore. Yeah. Japan, in China, but also.
Yeah, no Singapore.
So it's the same.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
But maybe it works. But that's what you're saying. You're saying that shame is there to work.
Right.
So why are we judging it?
Because we hate it. Because it's spiritual nausea. Shame is like just this. There's no peace when you're in a shame spasm. The whole book uses the language of shame spasm.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, we all experience it ourselves, but you can also see people like just in the middle of a shin mm-hmm. spasm and what it does, the distorting of a personality that it brings mm-hmm. upon us. It's
but you're saying it's very constructive, actually.
But even though it's but that's the whole premise.
Constructive though.
Is what?
It's constructive, but with a lot of destruction.
But that's what you're saying, that it's part of the process of wholeness, that you have the destruction for the reconstruction.
Right. It's like, but that's the premise of the book, is that no one escapes shame.
Right.
So clearly, Hashem feels like it is serving some purpose, or he wouldn't have brought it in here. Like, things that are just inescapable, they're clearly by prophecy.
People forget the second line, that if you shame another person, that's like killing them.
Right.
So
right.
You're murdering, even though people like to publicize their sins. That's in Heller Galbosch. It's a strange thing. I'm mm-hmm. not talking about their sins, but they do this, they do that. It's done to another person. Fatal.
Mm-hmm. Why did she say people are publicizing their sins?
But they talk about all these other areas that they do. If it's infidelity, if it's this, or they... People they publicize murderers and this and that. There's like a secret admiration for mafia and
but even on a much smaller level, we like to belittle ourselves. That shame of belittling ourselves comes from
ego. So it's a problem to belittle yourself publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Not
like to do it. I think because there's an ego aspect. We feel
self-segregation. Yeah, self-segregation means that like you feel like you have a purpose in life now that you degraded yourself, you could, you know, now you're okay. You validated that you did something bad, and now that you feel bad about it, or you told someone else, then it's okay. Now it's a tone.
Right.
Totally not. So there's
a little box right here that says acknowledging the exceptions. Mm-hmm. Our exploration of shame does not address the phenomenon that there's a subset of people who, for various psychological reasons, have come to take pleasure in being shamed. It's not a subject we have explored in these pages. Nevertheless, we would be remiss to not mention that the phenomenon exists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. But it is also true. Is that where we are?
Okay. Acknowledging the exceptions is the next page.
Right.
Here, Hashem beams.
No, but it is also true, I think, that sometimes...
Okay, but it is also true that sometimes integrity requires that a person not be intimidated by the threat of shame and instead find the courage to do what's right despite the risk of being shamed by those who think otherwise.
Like, you know, like happening on college campuses today, you know, Jews just having pride, maintaining pride in their Jewishness and not like kind of slinking away.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah.
In fact, as we will explore below, there's a certain amount of shame that is built into the individuation process. Mm-hmm. Consequently, in the spiritual journey from Ayin to Ani, from no self to yes self, one must be willing to stand firm and honor one's value despite the shame that it elicits. At the same time, one must also have the humility to change one's course if new information really does change one's mind and alter one's truth.
Right. That's, like the paradox of, on one hand, being proud and kind of self-affirming of what you've discovered in yourself and in your kind of experience of the world, and to hold, you know, stand by it even if it's not really mirrored in the people mm-hmm. and around you, but at the same time also maintaining a kind of pliability that enables you to stay open to mm-hmm. information that might actually be more true than what you thought was true. So, and it's, and that's kind of a challenge, it's a challenge for the personality to hold both of those practices.
Continue?
Yeah. Right. So, at the same
time. Well, we
right here, Hashem.
So you can read that.
No.
Hashem deems that the world will be built from prima materia, saturated with shame.
Right. So, because that's what we, in the very beginning of the Sefer, it was talking about where's the origin of shame? And the origin of shame is really in Shpirat HaKelim, where the seven universes created and destroyed, which are characterized in the top, in Kabbalah as seven kings that ruled and died. And each king, in the Shira, what happened was the lights came down, the lights were of a higher order than the Kalim were, the development of the Kalim at the time. And so the lights, that moment, that the lights were carrying Hashem's vision of the messianic, post-messianic perfection of creation. Like the thought of creation and the glory of it arose in the mind of Hashem and Kabbalistically emanated from the eyes of divinity, whatever that means, and encountered the vessel, and for a moment encountered each king, and for a moment he was identified with the Orion Self, with Hashem's vision of creation, like he was in a altered state of consciousness. And so the only thing that we really know that the texts tell us about that moment is that the king's consciousness, each king was Ani Amloch, identifying with the Orion Self, I want to rule, I want the universe to revolve around me. And that narcissistic state then engraved itself in the Kli, and the next moment, the ultimate shame of the shattering of that whole kingdom, that king and that kingdom. And so the rock, and we are built from the raw materials of those seven shattered fallen kings. And so the embedded, engraved into the raw materials of our world is this, is a glimmer of the light of the ultimate redemption, a superdose of narcissism, and a superdose of shame. And that is where we start off. That's like the pile of
but at least it's normalized.
Right.
Otherwise we'd all be institutionalized.
Right, it's so true. It's so true.
Have you followed that humongous bazooka bubble that's bigger and bigger? And it's bigger and bigger because you're born into it. So it's magnificently. Collect your
journey. It was
magnificent half a second ago.
Yeah,
that's our journey.
Okay,
go on. Yeah. Learning to metabolize that shame must contribute something crucial to our mission. So to understand what that might be, let's examine the fine print of our job description.
Maybe that's when a baby's born.
they have very cool rules, babies, at the beginning. It's very simple. You're allowed to just want everything and that's it. Just be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You just be. You be. And everybody around you is, like, the rules are very clear there. You cannot take care of yourself. You could only need things all day. It's all very clear.
Right.
We are operating under the premise that actualizing the potential of relationship with God is the purpose of creation. Our job as sparks of the universe encompassing Shechina is to enable that relationship by functioning as an other vis-a-vis the Creator, while simultaneously knowing and declaring that despite appearances to the contrary, there really is nothing but the One.
Right. So that's also the paradoxical dilemma of I mean, we went through all the different five, I don't know about all of them, but five different explanations for why Hashem created creation. And one of them was for Hashem to experience self-revelation, there needs to be another to behold that revelation. And also just to remember, so that beholding of that revelation, what is it? What's the most panemia truth that Hashem, like, Kabbalistically, zivug, union, is seen and being, is happening, happens on the level of Da'at, which is seen and being seen, knowing and being known with loving eyes. And so, what is it, like, kind of in that job of beholding Hashem's revelation, so that kind of the most intimate encounter of seeing and being seen, what is it that Hashem wants us to know is His oneness. I mean, that's the most deepest, intimate truth that Hashem is wanting to reveal. And so, and yet it undermines, like, it puts us in a very difficult position, because if Hashem is one, then where are we? Who are we? It pulls the rug out from under our existence. It's a very complicated and challenging task that that we have to see Hashem, and the only way to do it is to go back and forth between these two states of Ani and Ayin. As Ani, we are the beholder, and as Ayin, as Ani, we are the beholder, and as Ayin, we Hashem Asad.
So what is the connection? If you speak about the two, they said that Yaakov is two separate ways.
That Yaakov is also an explanation.
So if the Yaakov is true, what there was in Yaakov, they actually expressed, I mean, some approach, they said the method, the Pneut of the Yaakov is a method, not a Chabin.
Also associated with Tiferet or something else?
Can, the Tiferet.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the connection in the truth that Yaakov holds in the general world, truth?
Boy, I don't know. I have to think about it. I don't know. I never studied him from that angle.
Because I was talking to David before we came about this, Yaakov is the truth. So are we hold in him, in a sense, the general truth in his own size?
Like going from general truth to specific truth.
Yeah. Or what he holds to the world,
This is what you're describing as truth?
No, she didn't.
It is Hashem's self-revelation. Is
the revelation is true.
But I have to sit and think about it. I can't do it off the top of my head.
Is there anything you're testing?
We're operating under the premise that the mechanism Hashem devised to produce this other is
called, i.e. us, this other, i.e. us, has
this others,
the other that precedes Hashem's revelation,
It's complicated indeed. In Shem plays a central role from beginning to end. As we have seen, the very step out of which we are built is a step
saturated,
saturated with narcissistic shame produced by the era of shattered vessels.
As I just explained.
And reinforced by our apparent blunder with tree of knowledge. Tikkun Olam is nothing but a transmutating of this draws into God, into the deepened relationship with Hashem. This is our mission and our pleasure.
Right. That's the goal. Somehow, that's where we're headed. And we're about to, I want to get through this, but we're about to then also go into some practical advice about how to get there, how to do that. Kabbalah informs us that relationships have a life cycle that divides into three phases, as we just discussed above, back-to-back enmeshment, surgical uncoupling, and then front-to-front or consummate encounter. Front and back here refer to the conscious and unconscious layers of the soul. Since front includes the face, eyes, and sense organs that comprise our field of awareness, Kabbalah employs that term to convey conscious will, actualized potential, and personalized expression. Conversely, back associates with all that is unconscious, instinctive, compulsive, unexamined, and transpersonal. Now, this is going to get a little bit dense, and so, you know, just kind of let it wash through and take what you can and let go what you can't, but it's, because it's kind of Kabbalah speak. I'll just read the next. In a back-to-back relationship, the glue that binds the parties is from did I just read this?
Yeah.
Okay. The glue, the glue that binds the parties is from unconscious compulsive forces that may even oppose their stated conscious intent. In contrast, a front-to-front relationship is one where the parties share common goals and a mutuality of desire, at least to some extent. To turn a back-facing union into a front-facing one, there must be an intervening nisira, a surgical uncoupling that severs the former to enable the latter. Hearing
you. Kabbalah further informs us that this striving for a more perfect front-to-front union is driven and directed by the Gevurot.
The Gevurot are these dark knots of unactualized potential generated in the Shvira that are the ones that are carrying this primordial shame and narcissism and also glory, and they're the driving force of our psyches. We all have some pile of them that are, the Gevurot are like springs that are always wanting to unpack themselves, and in unpacking, it's like pushing us forward to do this or do that. Like it's the motor of, it's a mechanism that Hashem devised to keep things moving.
So they're good.
Well, yeah, but they're dirty. I mean, they're not, when they're not, yet metakaned, they cause a lot of problems.
Uh huh. But ultimately, then they serve an important purpose.
Right. And the lesson is very big on the Gevurot, that really they're the ones that are the source of all the bliss and joy of Olam Haba and the world and the Messianic and post-Messianic.
Petroleum, when you start with it, this was the...
Right.
This is so important. This is the product of refined
soul. Right.
And it's transparent, and it's opaque, and it's stretchy to be whatever you want.
Right. There's a thing about it, isn't there? Yeah, right. Right. And it's called black gold in America.
Okay. For a more perfect front-to-front union is driven and directed by the Gevurot. Those dark knots of unactualized potential produced in the era of shattered vessels, which served as creation's propellant.
Not served in the past, but served in
served,
the present.
I'm sorry. Just served as creation's propellant. These Gevurot are never still. They're always seeking to improve their condition, an effort that proceeds on two fronts. One, cleaning out their Zohamic binder, the narcissistic shame, inherited from the Shvira of the Tree of Knowledge, and the Tree of Knowledge, as explained, and two, actualizing their glorious potentials, which also hark back to the primordial times. When practice occurs on either front, it leaves us more individuated,
and our relationship with Hashem more consummated for, says Kabbalah, actualizing self and deepening relationship are just two sides of the same coin. Phase three, front to front, consummate relationship is one where both parties are fully actualized. Only once they've achieved full stature can they meet in consummate union, core to core, and tip to toe.
So it's important to understand that this process of individuation and is essential to the to us reaching our messianic, post-messianic reward phase of history. Like it's not self-indulgence. It's like in order to, like we kind of in the different our exploration of the different purposes for creation. So we're working with the one that Hashem before creation, by definition, was lacking nothing, except in some mysterious sense, the experience of actualized relationship, because there was no other with whom to relate. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're, you know, that's our job, is to somehow do whatever we need to do in order to be able to meet Hashem in the most rectified relationship possible. And that requires us to be fully actualized, or 99.9% actualized, in order to be able to bring all of ourselves consciously into the relationship.
So the gevuros, in essence, is like tikkun amidos, or that are our personal tikkun and tachkis.
Yeah.
That everyone has to, it's best in Kabbalistic terms, but in actuality, that's here on a human level.
Right.
So whatever's propelling us, the shame or whatever it is that's propelling us to correct ourselves.
That's the signature of the Gevura, yeah. Okay. Who's up?
We all have a quota of Gevuros whose potential we must unpack, and whose impurities we must scout. Some of these Gevuros have already begun their journey of awakening, and as such comprise our conscious self. Other of these worlds remain as collapsed and tainted as ever, yet in that condition, their distinguishing features are completely hidden. Indeed, they all look the same, like dark cinders of light, laced with narcissism and shame. Only once they activate and begin to unfurl does their uniqueness poke through. This is akin to the difference between flower buds, which basically all look alike, versus their petaled flowers, which come in a magnificent variety of colors and petal shapes and fertilization strategies. To summarize, our job is to achieve a consummate relationship with Hashem. The path from here to there has three steps to it. Each of these steps entails some processing and mastery of shame.
Okay.
Back-to-back enmeshment. On the physical plane, closeness means proximity. On the non-physical plane, things are close when they are similar and distant, and distant when they are different. Consequently, in a still fallen state, the Gevuros bond around their shared taint, inherited from the era of shattered vessels, which serves as a kind of sticky wedding that maps them together. Conversely, our uniqueness at this point exists solely in its potential. It does not exert a strength of presence that can override the more primitive attachments of the growth that rule our unconscious backsides. In back-to-back relationships, the hurt instinct predominates over the drive to individuate.
Okay.
Nitsira, which is surgical uncoupling. Since enmeshment is produced by affinities that are unconscious and generic, it's severing occurs when the parties become self-aware and start to differentiate. Yet, this awakening also triggers shame, which actively opposes the task at hand. Evolutionary psychologists argue that shame evolved to inhibit behaviors that would estrange a person from community and the protection afforded by tribal affiliation.
Right, so that's one of the main proposals in sociology for why shame exists in the universe and is so pervasive, because it right. is kind of a survival tool in a certain way, that there's security in numbers, security in being part of the herd. Okay, keep going.
If the fear crosses two kinds of shame arise. One, community is an entity and so is
so that. This part is important, so read slowly.
Okay. Community is an entity unto itself, a higher order unity with a survival instinct all its own. Since it's true that there is strength in numbers, the community weakens when its census decreases. Consequently, its survival instinct actively discourages the individuation of each its members by shaming their attempts to distinguish themselves.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a conscious strategy, but a survival reflex that operates through the unconscious fears and vulnerabilities of its citizens.
Right. And so you can, if you can now see this, you can see it operating in mm-hmm. the communities. It's no blame, but it just is a, it's a very visible, it's a very visible, something to see in the world and also to then become aware of in one's own individuation, journey.
You have to think about it.
Right. But it's, it's just, go ahead.
I just wonder if it seems everything's such time, if it's really the other person. Because I experienced this a lot during 2020 with many things that I didn't want to do.
Uh-huh.
And many people, didn't like what I was doing, and I had to be strong and be individualized for whatever it is, you know?
Good for you,
But it caused me a lot of pain.
Right.
You know?
I mean, I was thinking about it, like, kind of, just like for a convert, you discourage them three times, and it kind of builds their muscle of will and commitment, because it's not going to be an easy thing to be a Jew. And so you do have to, and so I think with individuation as well, like kind of that having to negotiate all these resistances that are being, you know, coming from the outside and also from the inside, it kind of strengthens the commitment. I mean, that you're not going to succeed in individuating unless you're stubborn. You have pretty much a stiff neck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, two, when we as individuals begin our journey of self-discovery, we inevitably encounter thoughts and sensibilities that are not mirrored or even appreciated by others around us, our community. The more we delve into the mystery of our own self, the more differences we uncover between ourselves and our milieu. Okay, I can read it. One definition of shame is ego deflation that occurs when a big for emotional...
Wait, this is really important also. Okay. This is a very interesting definition of shame.
Okay, one definition of shame is ego deflation that occurs when a big for emotional communion elicits instead a response that is critical, indifferent, or contrary.
Yeah.
Thus, individuation inevitably produces shame. As we discover our unique selves, we seek approval from the world around us. Yet often that appreciation is not forthcoming, at least to the degree that it was sought. This lack of mirroring produces some measure of shame, and this becomes a major challenge to the self-actualization that is a prerequisite to our missions of consummate union with Hashem. We must learn to bear the inevitable shame that accompanies this delicate nisira. It helps to remember that the whole point of our uncoupling is to enable a higher, willful, and more rectified recoupling in the end.
Yes.
Which I guess I experienced enough.
Yeah, I mean, I think So, but it becomes a whole other thing when you see, oh, so that's what's happening here. So I can make a choice now, and it's not that I'm bad, or it's not that they're necessarily right, or, you know.
To accept my view?
Yeah.
Right, and often that is coming from their fear of survival, whatever it is,
right.
The family unit,
uh-huh.
wanting things to be what they think is right.
Right.
Yeah. To see that.
Yeah. But people have their interests.
You can include something as simple as the style of dress,
mm-hmm.
or the way you tie your tickle, or what does that say, or how did that elicit
right.
the the achdut, the communion of the Nisa, the youth of the earth.
Right.
Or not.
Right. Consummate social zones.
Consummate front-to-front encounter. This turning from back to front does not happen in one tectonic shift, but rather by increments, sliver by sliver, over time. In any given moment, there are unrectified layers enmeshed in a back-facing dysfunctional bond and rectified layers that are meeting metaphorically eye-to-eye, heart-to-heart. With each cycle of Nisira, the relationship deepens and sweetens as it turns ever more front-to-front. The more we unpack ourselves, the more content is available for front-facing union with Hashem. In this way, the burning shame that vexed our Nisira gets metabolized and then manifests in phase three, according to Kabbalah, as flames of love.
Shehuvin Durachimus.
Okay. This term applies to the Gevurot when infused with conscious awareness and fully extended in both stature and radiance. This mature and enlightened Ani now enjoys a consummate Zivekut with Hashem, meeting of tip to toe, a pleasure beyond all earthly delights. Yet there is always a new frontier. The purpose of creation is achieved as we spend our eternity in an ever-deepening union and reunion with our Creator.
Happy ending will be had by all. So perfect. It's exactly, we're right exactly out of time.
Happy to read the whole book.